And good evening, everybody. This is Sunday night, December 24th, Christmas Eve. Now, I've been kind of musing in the last few shows we've done about doing something special on Christmas Eve when I realized that this show fell on Christmas Eve. And I've always done, in my planetarium eras, I've always done the story of the Christmas star. So what I've done with the help of one of our really good guests, John, who has been a stalwart companion, and he recommended the guest that we're going to be introducing in a few moments here, and it's going to take us into realms that we didn't kind of know about back when I was doing the planetarium stuff and when I was doing radio. I remember my first Christmas radio show. It opens like this.
Let the night wind to the little land.
Today I'm at Anjumapura,
that
border crossing in Bangladesh.
Crazy.
As you can,
that is totally, totally crazy. That should not have happened. That is so bizarre. I'm sorry, folks. Okay, let's try that again. Whatever can happen with this system happens.
Do you see what I see?
Do you see what I see?
Way up in the sky, little lamb. Do you see what I see?
Do you see what I see?
For astronomers, the story of the Christmas star has been an astrophysical journey. From that original set of lines in Matthew, and we're going to talk about that in greater detail in a moment, the story has come down through centuries and now thousands of years that when the Christ child was lying in that manger, in the east there was this brilliant apparition, a star that was followed by wise men. And they came all the way from God knows how many thousand miles away, and found the child lying in a manger, and of course you guys probably know the rest of the story. Well, this song, which Bing Crosby recorded in 1962, I did not know until this afternoon that he recorded it literally November 22nd, 1962, as his friend was being killed in Dallas. So there's a lot of meaning behind this song about peace on earth to men of goodwill, and something appearing in the sky, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight with my guest, David Matheson. So let me give David a more formal introduction. David Warner Matheson investigates the evidence that the world's ancient myths, scriptures, and sacred stories are speaking a language of celestial metaphor. He's the author of 7 books exploring these connections, including the multi-volume series Star Myths of the World and How to Interpret Them, as well as Astrotheology for Life and the Undying Stars. He also publishes a blog, videos, and other material at www.starmythsworld.com. David's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, has a master's degree in literature from Texas A&M, and is taught in the Department of English and Philosophy at West Point, and has a love for the starry sky and for the world's ancient myths since he was a young child. David, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Thank you, Richard. Great to be here.
Well, let's see. Where should we begin? I guess I should start by asking, how did you get involved in stars and myth and decide that that was an occupation you wanted to pursue? Because I have the easy excuse that the planetarium. But I'm not quite sure how your road crossed with ours. So take a few moments and tell us how you got inspired.
Great. Thanks for asking, Dick. And I appreciate your listener who recommended that you invite me onto the show. I appreciate your graciously hosting me. I will say, I think in the intro, you said 1962. Of course, if it was recorded on that date in 62, that would be a year ahead of that infamous, terrible day in 63,
yeah,
right?
But they had to play it a few days after he had been killed. And that's they actually did the studio recording for the TVNBC show, I think, just a few days after Kennedy was killed. So,
right. I'm just saying, I think the assassination was in 63.
It was in 63. You're right. Yes.
Right. But sorry, I just wanted to make sure I understood what you were saying there. But I didn't know that about that at all.
I didn't either. And see, this has become one of my favorite Christmas songs because it kind of speaks to that timelessness of a celestial apparition, you know, portending something amazing happening on Earth. And we actually had a kind of a variant of this year, which I'll get into in the next couple, 3 hours. But please tell us how you got into this.
Right. So ever since I was a child, I was very loved the myths. I don't remember a time when I didn't have big picture books of the myths by the D'Alembert's illustrated myths of Greek myths and Norse myths. I loved the Odyssey. Even when I was pretty young, I remember reading different versions of the Odyssey. And as you mentioned later, I got to go back and teach at the military academy and got to teach a version, a translation of the Odyssey that didn't even exist when I was a child by the translation by Robert Fagles, which is a fantastic translation of the Odyssey. But that was wonderful. And I've also always loved the stars. I remember going out to look at the stars with my dad when I was little. And once again, I can't remember a time when I did not have the star books by H.A. Rey. And that's actually important. I don't know if your listeners, maybe it's out of context of how you usually hear H.A. Rey's name brought up. But off the top of your head, do you remember who H.A. Rey is? He's more well known for he and his wife, Margaret Rey, created a timeless series of children's books that they wrote and illustrated about Curious George. So the creator of Curious George also in 1952 published a wonderful volume called The Stars, A New Way to See Them. And that was what I grew up with for envisioning the constellations. And it's a wonderful system. As you might imagine, a great illustrator was able to really convey the best way to kind of envision the constellations in the sky. So I had those growing up, but it wasn't until kind of a series of synchronicities. I won't go down the whole chain, but when I started getting interested in the works of Graham Hancock, mainly because I gave a book by Graham Hancock, my parents were going to Machu Picchu, and I wanted to get some kind of book for my mother that had to do with Machu Picchu for her birthday right around that same time. And I searched around and found one by Graham Hancock. And then I said, wow, this looks really interesting because he's talking about Machu Picchu. And he mentions this book called Hamlet's Mill.
Oh, yes, of course.
And that was published in 1969, was really a seminal text for a lot of people. And Graham mentions Hamlet's Mill and other writers talk about Hamlet's Mill, which talks about this evidence that is found around the world that stars and that the myths around the world appear to have connections to or reflect what's going on in the sky. And they talk about this, they use these beautiful metaphors like it's this vast, ancient, worldwide ruin, this construction, this ancient system, which is now kind of forgotten, but we see glimpses of it and even ancient writers talking about it. You'll see glimpses in like Plato and Aristotle mentioning connections between the stars and the myths. And as you can imagine, for someone who grew up loving the myths and, you know, even getting an opportunity to teach the Odyssey at the college level, I was fascinated by that because at the time I was teaching the Odyssey, I had not encountered Hamlet's Mill. So I devoured that book. But it's a very complex and really not necessarily a satisfying explanation of the system. They basically say this system is going on, but they don't necessarily lay out the structure in any sort of comprehensive way. But I became completely fascinated by that. So I began to really delve into it. So the long answer to your question, that's what I've been really focusing on, that system, because it has a structure to it. It has, it's like a language that has its own grammar and its own vocabulary, and it is operating around the world from Australia, the sacred stories of the Aboriginal indigenous people of Australia, Africa, Asia, Europe, you know, the Greek myths, the Bible, what we call the Old and New Testaments of the Bible, the myths of Europe, including Scandinavia and the Americas, the sacred stories of the Native American and the Maya, and even across the vast Pacific Ocean, the stories about Maui. So that is that's a pretty paradigm shifting claim that all those myths around the world might be using a common worldwide system. But as the authors of Hamlet's Mill talk about, there's a lot of evidence that shows that that is in fact going on. So that's what I've really been exploring.
Well, I know when I was introduced to Hamlet's Mill, and I can never remember the two authors. They were at MIT. One was a man, one was a woman, scholars, but they wrote in a very academic style. And of course, the subject matter is, as you just said, incredibly complex, because what they're trying to do is to identify this standard astronomical phenomenon called precession, which is the nodding of the Earth's axis in space, swinging around so that it takes 26,000 years, even number, to make this one grand rotation. Plato called it the great year. And what they did, I'm garbling it.
Yeah, I think it's George, but that's a great memory, because you've got the right bios of the two authors. It's Herta von Decken, who is a woman, and Giorgio de Santillana, yeah, was the man, and they were both professors. And you're right, they were talking about precession. So go on.
So anyway, they looked at all kinds of myths, you know, young ones, old ones, ancient ones, hoary ones, ones with moss on their north side. And they found this thread down through time that all of these disparate cultures, and you listed a whole bunch of them, all over the world seem to have immortalized in mythology the idea that the Earth is not fixed in space, that it rotates, and it has this super rotation, this grand processional year of 26,000 years. And they make some very interesting, you know, leaps of not quite faith, but certainly extrapolation. And it's become kind of the cornerstone, the Bible, for looking at the sky in terms of celestial myths transposed to stuff on the ground. Now, your work, and I see that we have up on under David's items, remember, everyone goes to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on the banner. That takes you to tonight's guest page. Scroll down to David's items. The first item is the Matthew text relating to the Christmas star. By the way, okay, now it's clickable. It wasn't clickable before. Now it is. Why don't we start there, since that's the most prevalent myth of this season, which is that when the Christ child was born, this celestial thing appeared in the sky, and it led folks from thousands of miles away to the crib. How much of that is overlaid of centuries of telling and telling and retelling, and how much of that is based on some underlying truth, David?
Well, that's a great question, and I like the way you framed it. Now, I'll tell you this, when you dig into matters like this, and after a while you start to form some conclusions, and I'll tell you some of the conclusions that I've reached, maybe not everybody out there will share, but I will tell you that after a lot of looking, I'm going to start at the big picture, and then we'll jump down to what you're talking about, the star that guided the Magi or the Magi from the east to the place in Bethlehem. But the big picture, after looking at the Bible from Genesis to Revelation and the connections that you can make to the constellations, the conclusion that I've reached, and I'm not going to be dogmatic, but the conclusion that I've reached is that they are not speaking a literal language. That is what I believe the compelling, overwhelming, conclusive amount of evidence argues. So that does not mean, however, that they're not true. So you ask, well, how much of this has to do with a literal baby and how much of it is true? I would say that actually they can be conveying to us profound truths, but not necessarily literal history. Mm-hmm. They can be talking about other things, but not necessarily literal history. And like I said, the evidence that I've found is that this is a worldwide system. That means it's operating in ancient Egypt. It's operating in ancient Mesopotamia. And other analysts have looked at some of the myths of ancient Egypt and seen, well, wait a minute, there are connections here that appear to reflect what's going on in what we call the New Testament stories. In fact, there are some, I've written about some passages in Revelation that have very clear parallels to things that are written in the Egyptian Book of the Dead thousands of years earlier, or if there's something worldwide. So what I believe is that this is talking about a system that is really ancient, that predates ancient Egypt, predates ancient Mesopotamia, and shows up in different kind of costumes or different, the actors are different, it's actually the same actors around the world, but they're wearing different costumes in a different setting, maybe set in a different time period, speaking in different accents or different languages, but enacting very much, it's the same actors. And after a while, sometimes you'll be looking at a film and you'll say, wait, where have I seen her before? Or where have I seen him before? And then you say, oh, that's right. He played Winston Churchill in this other movie. And now he's Mr. Poe in this Lemony Snicket movie. And you say, oh, it's the same actor. Wow, he really looks different. And he sure has put on a totally different mustache and a totally different accent. And that's what's going on with these constellations or the various planets. And they are enacting, as you said, the heavenly cycles, precession being just one of those cycles. Basically, it's the longest cycle that appears, I think, in the myths. But there's the daily cycle, the daily rotation on our axis. There's definitely the annual cycle of our orbit throughout the year, throughout those seasons. And they are using those cycles to convey truths about something else. They're using it in an esoteric way. So it's a long answer to your question, but I believe these stories are esoteric in nature. They're to tell us about something that is on a different level than the literal level. Mm-hmm. I use the metaphor of the Karate Kid, you know, that original Karate Kid from 1984. It's still such a powerful movie, even when you watch the scene with waxing the car, wax on, wax off. And everybody remembers that scene, because it's so powerful, because Daniel-san gets so fed up and he says, why am I waxing the car? I'm supposed to be learning karate. And Mr. Miyagi finally tells him, I've actually been teaching you that. He actually doesn't say anything. He just shows him, show me wax the car. And then he shows him, this is actually about something completely different. You didn't know it was about karate. Wax the car will stop this punch that I'm going to throw at you. So what I'm saying is that these stories will convey to our understanding in a completely different way than literally messages about who we are, where we come from, the fact that there is a spiritual component to the universe. That's what they're trying to convey. But instead of laying it out in dry language, they tell you the story of Samson, who had great strength, or Solomon, who had great wisdom, or in the Greek myths, there's Psyche, and she comes down and she becomes married to a god named Eros. And those, it doesn't mean that Psyche had to exist as a literal person for that story to be telling us true things about ourselves. So I don't actually, and this may, you know, some listeners may say, well, wait a minute, but I don't actually believe that Samson needed to be a real literal historical person in order for his story to actually have profound impact on us. In fact, I think it has more impact on us if it's actually the story of Samson is actually about you. But if it's about some super strong person who lived a couple thousand years ago, what does that really have to do with you? It's not literal. It's esoteric. It's just like Mr. Miyagi using wax on, wax off to suddenly open Daniel-san's eyes. So then afterwards, you can learn when somebody says, do you know what Samson's story is really about? And then they tell you, it's actually about coming down into this human body and getting back in touch with who you are. Boom, it wakes you up. I'd have to explain to you how it works, but it's a system where it's like Mr. Miyagi has hidden karate within the moves of wax on, wax off, not in order to keep it from Daniel-san, but actually to teach it to him in an even more profound way. So with that being said, your question was how much of, I don't believe the Christ story is actually about a literal historical figure. I used to believe that very much,
mm-hmm.
but the more I saw that it's connected to the constellations and the motions of the, that everything in the Bible actually is based on the constellations, I had to start thinking about, well, what else could this be?
Wait. You just said something really interesting. You just said something really intriguing. Everything in the Bible is based on a celestial metaphor, a celestial connection?
So I would say virtually everything. I've got a book called Star Myths of the World, Volume 3, or Star Myths of the Bible. That's 766 pages of starting in Genesis and going through like the story of Moses and the different adventures that Moses has. You can trace those out. When you know this, how the system works, you can see the crossing of the Red Sea has to do with a certain part of the Milky Way and certain constellations on either side of the Milky Way, or Adam and Eve and the serpent are constellations in the heavens.
They get cast
out of paradise because every day the earth orbits on rotates on its axis. So the sun goes from east to west and sinks down out of the sky. The stars do the same thing. So when Adam and Eve and the serpent, all three of them get cast out of paradise because they're being cast down into the west, they're sinking down in the west. And the first one to go out is the serpent, the constellation Hydra. That's the first one to get cast out of the garden. Then the Lord addresses Eve and casts her out. That's the constellation Virgo, sinks out of the heavens next. And then finally turns to Adam and says, you came from the dust. That would be the, you rose up out of the eastern horizon, mm-hmm. and now you're going to return to the dust. You're going to sink down into the western horizon. Mm-hmm. So he gets cast out of the heavens third in order. And you can,
and
you can
what constellation do you identify as Adam?
Boötes is what I argue is Adam. Boötes is basically sitting above Virgo, and
oh,
Virgo actually.
I've always heard that interpreted as a herdsman. Boötes the herdsman.
Mm-hmm. He is the herdsman, and that's right. But he also plays all kinds of different figures. It's like I said about the actors will sometimes appear, and you'll say, "Wait a minute, playing a flute." You see, if you look at Boötes, and this is where H.A. Ray's outlines come in. So
you probably, for some crucial people, you probably need to spell that.
Yes, you're right. So it's B. O-O-T-E-S, and often that second O will have, I believe it's called an umlaut over it,
mm-hmm.
two dots.
Mm-hmm.
But you can actually see Boötes in picture number, well, he's actually a little too, oh yeah, you can see him on the very left corner of picture number 8 on Radio in Pictures.
Okay.
So he's right above Virgo. So a lot of times, but he has this long pipe. He has kind of a pipe. The stars, the way they're laid out, has a long pipe. So Krishna, the Lord Krishna, in the Vedic or the ancient Indian epics, will be playing a flute. And I believe there are a lot of reasons to believe that Boötes and Krishna line up with one another. For one thing, Krishna is the divine charioteer, and not to get too far off topic, but in the Bhagavad Gita, in this great battle, Krishna is driving the chariot. Well, Boötes actually looks like he is seated in a driving a chariot, the chariot in this case being the constellation Ophiuchus.
You know, what's interesting about Boötes is the brightest star in that constellation is Arcturus, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Arcturus was used in a photo multiplier system, electronic system, by the founders of the World Fair in Chicago in 1939, they used the light of Arcturus to turn on all the lights of the fair. because it was so many, I forget how many light years away, and that's what they were, you know, their kind of meta message. I'm wondering now whether they chose that star not because of what they claim, but because of deeper mythological associations.
You never know. That is very interesting. Arcturus is a very important star. In fact, it's a very important star to the people of Hawaii, and they call it Hokulea because it is at about 19 degrees north latitude in the celestial sphere, and the Hawaiian Islands are about 19 degrees. I know you'll be interested in that.
Well, 19.5 actually for Hawaii.
Well, Hawaii obviously is pretty big, but anyway, 19 and 19. So that means that Arcturus will be straight up overhead for them certain parts of the year. So it's a special star to them. But anyway, not to get, we could go into all kinds of different connections, but there are figures who play a flute or who blow a horn, like the angel Gabriel will blow a horn. Or in the Norse myths, there's a figure named Heimdall who has a horn, a great Yaller horn that he will blow to alert Asgard to any enemies coming up. So anytime you see a figure like that, you might suspect that it may line up with Boötes. But just to get back to the Christmas star, what I'm saying is I have found so much evidence from Genesis all the way to Revelation that these stories have very clear references to specific constellations and their distinctive features, such as the horn or the pipe of Boötes or the outstretched arm of Virgo, which you can see right below Boötes. I've kind of highlighted the outstretched arm of Virgo.
Okay, if we're going to refer to the diagrams, we need to direct people to which images we're looking at. That's why they have numbers. So where do you want to start?
Right.
And we only got like 2 or 3 minutes to the bottom of the hour, so we might want to set things up, and then we'll pick it up when we come back on the other side.
Right on. So we've been talking about a bunch of different constellations, and it is hard to visualize without seeing an image. So if you look at image 4 on Radio and Pictures, you will see I've drawn in the outlines. Those are the HA ray outlines in green of constellations. And Virgo is the figure who has her outstretched arm encircled with kind of a red starburst. Mm-hmm. You won't see that in the sky. I'm just calling attention to it because that outstretched arm is very important in the Star of Bethlehem myth. The interpretation that I'm going to lay out after we come back probably will involve that particular star. But the outstretched arm of Virgo will play a role in a lot of different myths, including, I believe, that's why it is Eve who reaches out to take the fruit in the story of the garden. It's been the people who take it literally have said, oh, well, that must mean that women are the root of all evil. No. I would argue that that is a misinterpretation. The reason why the woman is the one who takes the fruit is because Virgo is the one who has the outstretched arm in her outline. Then she offers it to her husband, Adam, Boötes, who's just sitting there. In fact, he doesn't even have any arms really in the outline in the heavens. But it's Virgo who does the plucking of the fruit, and she's the one who also gives the fruit to her husband. So those distinctive features of the different constellations will show up in the myths, and they'll show up in the stories of the Old and New Testament. All the episodes and all the characters that are described in the Bible, I would argue, are celestial in nature and have to do with these heavenly cycles.
Super. Well, I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour, first hour, and we only have David for maybe another hour. Then he has to go and do Christmas Eve stuff like all the rest of us should be doing. But we're deciding tonight to spend it with you. Believe me, it's important that we spend it with you. Okay. David Matheson is my guest. We're talking about mythology, and most interesting, the mythology connecting to everything. The celestial sky, the celestial connections that we actually all share. You're on the other side of midnight. And my name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And welcome back on this Christmas Eve, December 24th, 2017. A most amazing year. A year that is coming as a kind of a prelude to 2018. And I think that's what we're going to be finding out a lot more about in the next couple hours, because I think an amazing Christmas present is coming for the human race, and we'll see whether or not that is fulfilled. My guest this morning, David Matheson, is going to resume now. David, why don't we talk specifically about the Christmas star, because time is getting short. And in terms of the mythology, it's your position, I take it, that this is all metaphor, invoking a much deeper set of truths than has been discussed in, shall we say, planetaria for eons and eons. And I remember having to set up the Christmas star at the Hayden Planetarium in New York. And, you know, we didn't get into any of the really interesting stuff that we've now kind of figured out in later years. I mean, Hamlet's Mill was only written in 1969. And it was from that moment that a lot of scholars and an awful lot of people at a lot of different levels began looking at the sky in different ways. So take it away.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I think it's important to put in the historical context just real quick before I jump in there, because like you said, Hamlet's Mill wasn't published until 1969, but there were people who they refer back to. They refer back to many 1800s and 1700s scholars in, you know, 19th century, 18th century. A lot of times, like you said, they're kind of scholarly. So they'll quote them in the original German or the original Latin or whatever, French, and they don't translate it for you. But you can even read Hamlet's Mill online. But the text is kind of frustrating because I believe they did not have the system of H.A. Rey. It was published in 1952, but as you said, they were scholars who had been, they were writing that at kind of at the end of a long career. And I'm not so sure they knew about H.A. Rey's outlines, but his outlines really help you to see the connection. So there's only a few places within Hamlet's Mill where they really come out and say, this myth tracks exactly to this constellation. Otherwise, they'll say, well, the reader will know what I mean. And then they'll move on and you'll say, what? Wait, come back. But so anyway, so I believe that the outlining of H.A. Rey is so helpful. But it's also really neat that you used to work in planetariums, because I could go off on a whole tangent about how much I loved going to planetariums when I was little as well. I used to go to the Rosicrucian Museum in San Jose. I know you've spent some time in the Bay Area, and they have the oldest planetarium in San Jose. It's the oldest planetarium west of the Mississippi, I believe. Mm-hmm. And they have some really neat planetarium shows. I remember some specific ones. I won't get into them, but there was one that specifically talked about precession that was fascinating. But now let's dial it in, because we've been building up that we're going to talk about the Christmas star. And so far it's, 35 minutes past the hour. I haven't really revealed what I think about it. So I believe this is actually one of the stories where it is clear that the text is not talking about literal terrestrial history, but that it's talking about actions that take place in the sky. And one of the reasons I believe that, and I'll tell you that a lot of this analysis, I've done a lot of analysis that's my own, that's beyond some of the things that they talk about in Hamlet's Mill. I get into some things because I've got that H.A. Rey. But this analysis actually comes from a gentleman named Robert Taylor, the Reverend Robert Taylor, who lived from 1784 to 1844, who actually trained to be, I think, a doctor, a medical doctor. But he was so evangelical in his thinking, he was someone convinced him to go into the ministry. He was also a great orator. They said, oh, you'll be a great preacher. But he began to really look at the text closely, and he became convinced that they're based on the stars. And he actually got lost his income because of that. He was put in jail because of that. He was defrocked because of that. But he said, well, I'm not going to pretend to think that these are literal when I can see that they're based on the stars. So he started preaching about the connections to the stars in the 1800s. And so those books are, I've actually got links to them on my website. There's a resources page. But I'll just tell you that a lot of this argument comes from Robert Taylor. And he points out that in the Matthew 2 passage, the star is only mentioned, this visit of the Magi is mentioned in the Matthew account. We have four different gospel accounts. We could get into that. Has to do with, there's the two solstices and the two equinoxes. You've got two you got one that's very long, one that's very short, and two that are about the same length. Anyway,
well,
there's a lot
let's actually get into Matthew, because to me, this is the way that I got into the idea that at Christmas, you know, this child, this person, this Messiah, this savior of humankind was signified in the heavens by a star. Now, it's kind of cliche, you know, they talk about, you know, comets appear at the death of kings and that kind of thing. And Caesar was very concerned about a comet that I guess appeared just before he was murdered. But the Matthew quote is so simple and elegant, and it's to me, it's contained interesting information nuggets in terms of the wise men. Now it says, now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem. And then you skip down and you say, when they heard the king, they departed. He was this was Herod, of course, they'd been with. And lo, the star which they saw in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. And of course, astronomers have had a devil of a time trying to figure out astronomically what kind of star could move and guide, you know, travelers on camels from distant lands and last for months, because it didn't happen overnight. And, you know, they kind of almost tied themselves in knots. And in fact, they're kind of two major camps in the scientific world. One thinks it was a nova or maybe a supernova, except we can't find anything in the sky that's at the right date. And the other says that it was an astrological asterism of two or three planets in the constellation of Pisces that was significant to the Jewish people. Do you come down on any of those, David?
No, and I'll tell you why.
Okay, well, that's why you're here.
I'll tell you why. Because the reason I underlined verse 2 and verse 9, which you can see in picture 1 on Radio and Pictures, is because where did the wise men come from? From the east. Okay. Now, the star went before them and guided them to where the young child was in Bethlehem, right? We understand that he's born in Bethlehem. Well, that does not work very well for a terrestrial anywhere on the world, whether it's Jerusalem, Bethlehem, which is just south of Jerusalem. It doesn't work anywhere on the planet, on the physical terrestrial ball. You don't start in the east and follow something that you see in the east and get to a point that is in the west, mm-hmm. right? Did the wise men follow the star? They started in the east. They're usually portrayed as being from Persia or somewhere, you know, you can see on this map that I have there on page 2 or slide number 2 or somewhere in Arabia. But they're coming from the east. They're obviously not coming from the west because there's the Mediterranean Sea there. But if they followed a star that they saw in the east, what did they do? Go all the way to China and then cross the Pacific Ocean and then cross America and then cross the Atlantic and then land in North Africa and keep going to the east until they got to Bethlehem. So it does not work for a terrestrial, but it works very well if they're talking about, like I said, Adam and Eve are in the heavens. The paradise that they got cast out of was the starry heavens, just like we get cast down into this mortal body. And when they get cast out of the heavens, the text says God gave them coats of skin. That's exactly what happens to us. We get cast down and we get put into a coat of skin. It's talking about, hey, you're going through this incarnate life, but there is, as Paul says in his letters, a Christ within, or a higher self. And he says, don't you know, you foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? That I'm talking about an inner Christ. Okay, so I believe that this passage, when it talks about them coming from the east and following a star that they see in the east, or seeing his star in the east, we can dispense with trying to figure out a comet or a, maybe it's Jupiter in retrograde. Mm. None of that works for them following something that they see in the east, unless they circumnavigated the globe, because they'd be traveling to the east. But the stars travel, all the stars begin in the east. Just like this Earth's rotation causes the sun to rise, which is a star, in the east and cross our sky during the day and then set in the west. The stars also, if you stay out at night, if you just lie out in a lawn chair and watch them all night, you'll see.
Many a night.
Right. And you see this constellation rise up in the east. Oh, there's Orion looming up in the east. And then, and I've drawn in slide three a little red arrow just to show this is a picture looking to the south. So you see Orion there.
Okay. So we need to click on number three, right?
Number three. So if you look at number three, you will see that I have taken a screenshot from the online Stellarium. It's a planetarium app that's a free open source. You can download it to your computer for free. The app is called Stellarium, and I use that for a screen grab. But here I am looking towards the south, and you can see on your left, if we're looking towards the south, left will be east and right will be west.
Yep.
Obviously, if we're looking north, if we're looking north, right's on our east, but since we're looking south, right is west. So those stars are going to rise on the left of our screen, cross the sky in kind of an arc like the sun does. I've drawn the arc in a red dashed arrow for you, and then set down into the west. And not many people are today, this is what H.A. Rey was trying to address. Not many people are as familiar with all the constellations, but they're wonderful to become familiar with, and you can do it if you use H.A. Rey and go out each night and they'll become familiar to you. But a lot of people are familiar with Orion because he's so bright, has this belt of three stars. By the way, I'm saying he, but all these figures actually play, they will play male figures in myth, and they will also play female figures in myth. Even the constellation Hercules, who plays a lot of powerful male characters, will also play female characters. But so forgive me if I use him just because Orion is usually thought of as this hunter from Greek myth, but Orion has these three belt stars, very famous. I know you've mentioned them by name and, as important stars, they, are really familiar to a lot of people. They're very distinctive and easy to find. And those three belt stars, I believe, and this is following Robert Taylor, correspond to the three kings. And I'm not just.
Oh my gosh, David.
And they're starting in the east.
Oh
they're
my
starting in
gosh.
The east. And you may say, well, you know, three and three kings. That's, it doesn't even say three magi in the New Testament text. So come on, aren't you reaching? I'll tell you, there's a lot more evidence that I'm going to layer onto this to show that I'm pretty convinced this is the right answer. But if they start in the east, as they cruise across the sky, what's going to happen is the star of the child, of the divine child, they're going to see it in the east. So it works very well for an action that's going on in the heavens. What I was trying to show with that map is doesn't work very well for something on the terrestrial planet. Because if I said wise men came from New York and followed a star that they saw in the east, you wouldn't expect them to end up in California. Just wouldn't work. So I believe this is a celestial action that's taking place. So those three stars, remember, they do bring three gifts, frankincense and myrrh. And that's why, you know, they've kind of come down in history and tradition as well. It's the three kings from, you know, there's the Christmas carol, We Three Kings. They're coming from the east and they're crossing the sky. And then in slide four, if everyone just takes a moment to click on radio and pictures number four, you will see that the little timeline, I've got my my time at the bottom right. I've advanced the planetarium to about 4 a.m. This is just, I'm just showing how this moves them across the sky. Now, Orion, you can see basically straight up from the day and time, you can see those three stars of Orion.
Yeah, it's way over there in the west. Okay.
Right, in the west, about above the number 2017 for the year.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look up, you'll see the three stars of Orion have now come from the east, and they see his star in the west. And what I'm going to argue is there's a constellation rising. They see a star in the east. Sorry. They are sinking down in the west, but they see his star in the east. Who is rising in the east? Virgo. Virgo is a zodiac constellation, and the name means, as you might be able to guess, the Virgin.
The Virgin, yes.
Well,
so we're looking at virgin birth, et cetera. Okay.
That's right. So we have a virgin who is holding on her lap the Christ child, or she's holding the child. And on slide number five or image five on radio and pictures, I'm showing this is actually a statue from ancient Egypt.
Yeah, this is Isis and Horus.
That's the goddess Isis with Horus. But notice that she has an outstretched arm. And where is the child located? At the end of her outstretched arm. So what Robert Taylor argues, I don't think he invokes Isis, but I found this image to illustrate. There are actually a lot of parallels, and people have alleged this other than myself, that the Isis, Osiris, Horus story has many parallels to the Christ story.
Yes,
there's
exactly.
There's two mothers. I mean, we could go into a lot of different parallels, but just bear with me. I'm trying to illustrate that the divine child is associated with the end of her outstretched arm. So you see the constellation Virgo, which I've put a little starburst around that outstretched, that star that forms her outstretched arm.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second brightest star in the constellation Virgo. Her brightest star is actually Spica. Spica is down in her hip. It's at the top of that little blue line that I drew there, which I'm going to address that blue line in a moment. But that star at the top of her hip that's drawn largest, that's the brightest star in Spica. And you can see it early in the morning. If you get up at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m., you can see Spica in the as Virgo is rising. But the second brightest star is called Vinda Meatrix, which is a long Latin name. It actually means the fruit plucker or the vine plucker, and it actually has a feminine ending. It's like the vine plucker. It ends with R-I-X, just like words that came into English like with a E-S-S, like actress. Well, anyway, that fruit plucking hand, remember I said I think Eve plucks the fruit with that same hand?
Mm-hmm.
That star is the divine child, and you can see it very clearly in that statuette that I've the picture is perfect because it's from the side and you can see her outstretched arm. That is where the baby was envisioned that she's carrying. And you can see that Isis also corresponds to Virgo. Look at what she's got on her head in that blue statuette in slide number five we're looking at.
Yeah, this is supposed to be her throne.
That's her throne. Why do they put it on top of her head like that? You know, she's already sitting on a throne.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look at the outline of Virgo. Virgo has a distinctive kind of seated posture in the night sky.
Okay.
And if you look at the outline of that the stars actually make, I've outlined them in that same light blue color. You can see that kind of stepped throne
now,
that she has
just,
in her head.
Just for people who are just of you who are following this, the statue is reversed from the constellation. So you're looking at it facing the opposite direction. So
good point. But anyway, what I'm arguing is that the Virgin's child is envisioned there at the end of her arm. And you'll see in Madonna pictures, or I'm arguing that the star that they see in the east, these three kings came from the east, they see his star in the east. And some people may think, well, this is quite a stretch. Come on, you really expect me to believe all this? I'll give you a couple more clues from the text. So let's move to number six. So if everyone who's able to see the images online can click on number six, you'll see the same illustration, the same stars in the same positions that I was just talking about. The wise men are now sinking down in the west, but they came from the east. All the way across on the other side, rising the east, we have the Virgin Virgo with the Holy Child. They can see her star. They can see the star of her child rising in the east. And in between them, I've drawn a purple arrow. And if you're not able, if you're just listening on a podcast and not able, you can go to any planetarium and set this up. At the at its culminating point, at the highest point in the sky, that purple arrow is pointing to the constellation Cancer the Crab. Cancer the Crab is in between Orion and Virgo. It's actually in between Taurus. It's on the zodiac band. Taurus, then comes Gemini, then comes Cancer, then comes Leo, then comes Virgo. So you can see that Orion, who's about equal with Taurus, is about this equal distance from Cancer, is in between them, perfectly in between. Taurus, then Gemini, then Cancer,
mm-hmm.
Cancer, then Leo, then Virgo. So they're equidistant. So Cancer will be at the highest point in the sky. And Cancer is a faint constellation, but it has a beautiful little cluster inside, in between the two stars. It's a dim constellation, but you can see this dazzling cluster that's called the Beehive Cluster. If you know where to look, look in front of the mouth of the lion, Leo, if you can find Leo. So he's rising now in the east around, you can definitely see Leo around midnight. He's rising a little earlier than that. But what I'm telling you is that the Beehive Cluster, that's why we have so many stories about lions with a bee coming out of their mouth, or Samson takes the honey out of the mouth of the lion. If you go back to Judges 14, that's one of the stories that really got me started on this. Hamlet's Mill actually discusses that one. But anyway,
and if I was going to digress us really, really far, I'd ask about Utah, the Beehive State, and the Mormons.
Yeah. So beehives are super important throughout sacred traditions around the world. Even in Crete, you know, ancient Crete, the beehives, or in ancient Mesopotamia. So certainly the Mormons, you know, have the beehive. You see it on the road signs, right, in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
So, but let's talk about that Beehive Cluster. So this is from Robert Taylor, but what he explains is that Beehive Cluster is culminating at the highest point in the sky when the wise men who came from the east are sinking down in the west, and the Virgin with her holy child, the star, that holy child star, is rising in the east. The Beehive Cluster is right at the top of the sky. And this is not, what I'm about to tell you is not in dispute. You can look it up on Wikipedia or others. And, you know, there's plenty of sources that will confirm this. The ancient, an ancient name for the Beehive Cluster was Praesepe, Praesepe. And that means the manger. That is the Latin
word. Oh, my gosh.
The manger. So it would work just very perfectly. So if you say, well, three stars, three kings, they are the very bright stars, very distinctive stars, but still that's a stretch. Or, okay, well, we have Isis with her child lining up with Virgo, but you're still making a stretch. There are so many, there are many confirming details that means that help us to understand that we're probably on the right track here. And the reason why, so what Robert Taylor explains is the what happens is the solstice is when the sun reaches its lowest point on its track. It's
right.
The winter solstice for lowest point is winter solstice. Highest point is summer solstice. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, we've just passed the winter solstice, shortest day of the year. The sun, the days have been getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Are they ever going to turn around? Is the sun ever going to make it start to have go higher on its arc across the sky? Are we going to ever have days start to lengthen? Yes. But there's a pause. There's this 3-day pause. So what happens is we celebrate that divine birth at midnight on the 24th. That is the time when the sun turns back around and is reborn. The year is reborn. That's when there's all this ancient celestial symbology. These myths were trying to tell us about spiritual matters. So it has to do with personal rebirth, reconnecting with your higher self. But that happens at midnight on the 24th. So what constellation is up there at midnight on the 24th? That will be the sun is being reborn on the other side of the earth, because at midnight you're pointed directly away from the sun. If you believe that the earth is rotating on its axis, as I do, you're pointing away from the sun. So that's when the sun is reborn. So is being born in the manger. That's what's going on, is the sun is being reborn in the manger. So that's why the Christ child is born in a manger. And the reason why the beehive cluster was called that, the Praesepe, the manger, the two little faint stars of Cancer the crab on either side of the beehive cluster are actually called Acellus borealis and Acellus australis. And those two, Acellus is actually the Latin word for a donkey. So it means the northern and southern donkey colts. So in between them, they have a manger to munch some hay out of. So that's why the ancients referred to that cluster. Some ancients referred to that cluster as the manger. And that's why the baby is laid in a manger. So this whole scene sets up perfectly for, it sets up perfectly in the heavens. That's what I believe is going on. So the star that they see, I believe, is that star in the Virgin constellation that represents the baby in all these ancient myths around the world. I believe they're all related.
Well, the obvious question is, why is that star singled out as the most important star? I mean, it's celestially, it's kind of nondescript. It's the only the second brightest in Virgo, and it's not that bright, probably second, third magnitude. Why was that singled out to be the central part of this incredible 2,000-year-old story?
Because that's where the Virgin is holding the baby. So they are talking about a virgin's baby here in this story. That's where she's holding the baby, basically, you know, near her breast there, okay, on the end of her.
Okay, we only got a couple of minutes at the top of the hour. Obviously, you're going to stay over, and we're going to finish this on the other side, and then we'll bring in our other participants of the morning conversation, and I'm sure they'll have a couple of three questions, or three dozen, or 300 to ask you, David. So I'll tell you what, why don't we pause it right there? My guest this morning is David Matheson, and we're trying to do something that I have never done. I'm trying to connect the standard astrophysical, you know, Christmas star idea with the idea that there's mythology connected, storytelling in the celestial heavens, a la, you know, Hamlet's Mill. It came upon a midnight clear. Go outside tonight, midnight. In some places, it'll be in an hour. In some places, it's already happened. But go outside anyway. And during this break, take a look at the sky. And pretty impressive. Pretty impressive. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight. And we shall return. Thanks for listening to this exciting first hour. Now, the second and third hour of the show is available to Club 19.5 members only. Please support the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 and join our very interesting community. To do that, please visit the website, theothersideofmidnight.com, and click on the Join Club 19.5 link in the left-hand column. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350-plus shows that we have done. Now, recent Club 19.5 member archive recording have the commercials removed, and the sound quality has been enhanced. You'll also receive a dedicated private podcast feed that contains these enhanced show recordings. And you'll be able to download the MP3 files directly from the archive if you prefer. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll have access to a private chat server that member used to chat about the show during the show, and you will have a direct channel to post a question that will be read on the air to the guest. And you'll have a place to post questions during our open hailing frequencies. We realize that not everyone wants to call in live, and this gives you an easy way to participate in a live show without having to participate. Club 19.5 members can use this private chat to talk about the shows, ask questions, suggest new guests, and I may even pop on from time to time to answer specific questions. Also, the entire Bridge crew is in these participating chat channels, so you can interact with them as well. You'll also be the first to preview our new videos and reports. We'll be adding exclusive new features to Club 19.5 as we go forward, and boy, have we got some amazing things to tell you about in the coming weeks. So please support the show and don't miss all the exciting new things we have planned. I want to thank all our Club 19.5 members because Without your guys' support, this show would not be on the air. Please help us continue growing the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 today. And when I say we really need you, we really need you. Over and out. Thank you.